Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Not Just Yesterday, the Roddy McDowell podcast. This is the final episode of my series of podcasts regarding the Planet of the Apes movie franchise. But don't fret, as it will not be my last Apes episode. That's right. I still have one large Apes project remaining before I will truly be done with Apes altogether. Sometime next year, I am planning to do a series of episodes on the Planet of the Apes television series, which aired and ended in 1974. I will announce it when the time has come for me to be able to do this series, but for the meantime, the remainder of 2018 has many wonderful things planned for your enjoyment. Having said that, I will now begin with Episode 8, Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
In the beginning, God created beast and man, so that both might live in friendship and share dominion over a world at peace. But in the fullness of time, evil men betrayed God's trust, and in disobedience to his holy word waged bloody wars, not only against their own kind, but against the apes whom they reduced to slavery. Then God in his wrath sent the world a savior, miraculously born of two apes, who had descended on Earth from Earth's own future. And man was afraid, for both parent apes possessed the power of speech.
Come on!
So both were brutally murdered. But the child ape survived, and grew up to set his fellow creatures free from the yoke of human slavery.
No.
Yet, in the aftermath of his victory, the surface of the world was ravaged by the vilest war in human history. The great cities of the world split asunder and were flattened. And out of one such city, our Savior led a remnant of those who survived in search of greener pastures, where ape and human might forever live in friendship according to divine will. His name was Caesar, and this is his story in those far-off days.
Every night at 7, you walk in as fresh as clover, and I begin to sigh all over again. Every night at 7, you come by like May returning, and me, oh my, I start in yearning again. You seem to bring faraway spring near me. I'm always in full bloom when you're in the room, for every night at 7. Every time the same thing happens, I fall once again in love, but only with you.
The year is 2670. The setting, North America. Our story begins with a gorilla riding at a very fast pace toward the ape civilization as the credits roll before us. The scenery is sweeping, majestic, rustic, and beautiful. Green grass, vast rolling hills, and tall gray mountains paint the horizon, with black naked trees peppering the scene at various points. The gorilla finally reaches his destination and slows his pace as he enters the center of town. He looks around as apes and humans watch him arrive. Tired of being watched, he speeds his horse on, nearly running apes over on his way. He soon stops at a cart where two men are struggling to put the wheel back onto a broken spoke. Bruce McDonald, the brother of Governor Breck's assistant from Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, laughingly pats the man's back, who is desperately trying to pry the cart high enough off the ground to replace the wheel, and tells him, "You're not gonna make it, Jake." The man is optimistic and announces that they will indeed make it. The gorilla we've seen riding by has stopped and walks over to the men fighting with the cart. Pushing the man with a pole backwards so that he drops his lever, the gorilla announces, "I'll show you how," and proudly walks over to the broken wheel spoke section of the cart. He then places his full body weight against the cart and pushes with his full strength against it. The cart easily rises up. The men replace the wheel in seconds and thank the ape.
"Thanks, Aldo.
You will call me by my proper rank, General."
Yes, General.
Aldo, having just been properly introduced to the audience, now leaves to go across the camp and arrives at a small schoolroom where apes are learning to read one of the laws of ape kind, commandment number one of the apes' 10 commandments, as it were. Ape shall never kill ape. Instantly upon arrival, Aldo, apparently typical and resorting to contrary behavior, interrupts the lesson by asking the teacher,
"Shall ape ever kill man?"
"You're late, General Aldo. Come and read this to the class."
"I won't."
"You won't because you can't. And you can't because you don't want to learn. And it is my duty to report this to Caesar."
"If my father were a gorilla, we'd all be learning writing instead of writing."
We have just been introduced to Caesar and Lisa's son, Cornelius, named for Caesar's father. He is very small and inquisitive, and has a thirst to learn, but he seems more interested in activities which breed knowledge and maturity of the sort opposite to academia. Cornelius loves to ride, climb trees, and feed his pet squirrel, Ricky, among other things, all of which, though he is a good student, he would much rather be doing at the present moment. He does, however, show diligence, and follows out the teacher's instructions with fervor and interest. Outside of the main classroom, another lesson is being carried on, that regarding the relativity of time. It is being taught by Virgil, one of the many orangutan philosophers in the community. He is most interested in the science of the unexplained, and enjoys most above all else theorizing with those who are willing to listen and participate. During the regular class times for the apes who do not yet know how to read and write, he conducts classes of the mind, where he discusses with his students theories for things that cannot be easily explained.
"But Virgil, can we tamper with time?"
"Accept my premise."
"What premise?"
"That since man once learned to travel faster than sound, could later have learned to travel faster than light."
"We accept."
"Then imagine a musician giving a live broadcast from what was once London to what was once New York on a Wednesday. He then travels faster than light from London to New York, where he arrives, or, as physicists would confirm, on the previous Tuesday, listens to his own broadcast on the Wednesday, dislikes its quality intensely, and then travels back faster than light to London in time for him to decide not to give his broadcast." "Come, I'll prove it to you logically."
Meanwhile, Aldo is struggling intensely with carrying out the teacher's instructions on copying down the first and most important of ape law. He has no patience for anything beyond his capacity and has no desire to learn due to his lack of long-suffering. He therefore throws down his charcoal and begins tearing a bit at the papers in his hands as Cornelius successfully hands in his assignment to the teacher. Cornelius makes his assignment a sweet one, writing, "Ape shall never kill Abe," and gifts it to his teacher, who accepts it with a soft heart. It has now come to Aldo's turn, and his experience is not sweet as Cornelius's. When Abe corrects Aldo's illegible handwriting and his pitiful formations of various letters in front of the class, telling him that his capital A leans over like a tent in a high wind, the class begins to laugh. Embarrassed and wishing for revenge, Aldo picks up the paper given to Abe by Cornelius, reads it aloud sardonically, and then begins ripping up the paper. Without thinking, Abe stands up and shouts,
"No, Aldo, no!"
In his shock from Aldo's actions of ripping up the loving sentiment written by Cornelius, Abe, forgetting himself completely, uttered the unspeakable word, breaking the second most important commandment in ape law. Virgil, who is nearby with his students and overhears, immediately runs to his aid. Virgil is confidant and advisor to Caesar, and feels that he should explain the situation to prevent severe punishment being pronounced upon the teacher. After telling Abe that he must apologize to Aldo and go home while he puts in a good word for him with Caesar, Virgil leaves, immediately seeking out private counsel with his king. Abe, having a humble spirit and realizing the seriousness of his offense, turns to offer his apologies to Aldo.
"General Aldo, I'm sorry.
The writing you destroyed was by Caesar's son. I did not want you to suffer Caesar's anger."
"What do I care for Caesar's anger? Let me give you a taste of mine."
Furious, Aldo begins viciously destroying the schoolroom. Seeing that Abe is seeking to find Caesar, Aldo gathers his troops and leads them in chase, trying to prevent Abe from reaching their king. They soon run directly into the path of Caesar himself, who orders them to...
Stop!
We'll teach the teacher a lesson. Throw him in the corral, where all humans belong.
I said stop, Aldo!
He broke the law. With his own mouth, he broke the first law.
I am the law. What has he done?
Caesar! I was there. Teacher only reverted to type under provocation. He spoke like a slave master in the old days of our servitude when we were conditioned to mechanical obedience. He uttered a negative imperative.
Could you put that into words which even Caesar could understand?
He said no, Aldo, no. The schoolroom was wrecked.
The class is ended. The schoolroom is closed. Now we go back to riding horses.
Aldo!
You and your friends will return to the schoolroom and put it back in order. Abe, no gorilla is to be dismissed until everything is back in its place.
Yes, Caesar.
Father, since there won't be any more school today, may I go and play?
Can't you study in the house?
I could, Father, but...
Run along and play.
Where are my students? I was just in the midst of explaining my theory of time relativity. If Caesar permits, I would like...
Caesar permits.
Thank God.
You look concerned, MacDonald.
I am, Caesar. I think that Aldo's hatred is not confined to humans.
At the exact moment of MacDonald's pronouncement, Aldo, rebelling outwardly against Caesar's orders, rides his horse at breakneck speed, directing his horse point blank in Caesar's direction. MacDonald sees them coming and yanks Caesar to safety just in time to prevent a bloody collision. Angrily, Caesar comments,
I think Aldo may be riding for a fall.
Indeed, as the proverb states, pride goeth before a fall, and Aldo's pride is definitely in need of a serious adjustment. Aware of this, and wondering just how to deal with it, not only for the safety of himself, but also for the safety of the community for which he, as king, is responsible, Caesar wonders out loud to MacDonald how his parents would have handled the situation he now finds himself in.
Oh, if only my mother and father, whom I was too young to remember, if only they'd lived, perhaps they would have taught me if it was right to kill evil so that good should prevail.
But you know, Caesar, history shows...
Well, that is human history. Not ape history. Ape never kills ape.
Here's the list of our winter supplies so far.
Oh.
Well, I've got to be getting along. I'm starving. I could eat a horse.
A horse?
Oh, you remember, Lisa. Oh, they used to eat lots of things. You know, dead cattle, dead chickens, dead pigs.
Now we live and chew nuts at our master's command.
That will be all, Julie.
Thank you.
We are not your masters.
We're not your equals.
MacDonald, I believe that when you truly... grow to know and trust a person, you cannot help but like him. Now, when we grow to know and trust your people, then we shall all be equals and remain so until the end of the world.
Which may be sooner than you think.
You are such a pessimist.
Or a prophet.
Well, now that apes are at the helm, Earth will sail safely through space until the end of time. And Virgil says time has no end. So you see, I cannot believe you.
Would you believe it if you heard it from the lips of your own parents?
Are my parents alive?
No. But their images and their voices are.
MacDonald, when you talk about my parents, please do not speak in riddles. I cannot see them, I cannot hear them. Amanda's only told me they came out of the future. They cannot give me knowledge.
Caesar, you can see them. You can hear them. And they can give you knowledge.
How?
Under the Dead City, we once lived, in the archives, near the old command post? There are tapes, sealed tapes of Cornelius and Zira, being examined by officials of the American government. When my brother was Governor Breck's assistant, he told me about them. I know where they are, and I know that they concern Earth's future, from which your parents came.
But the city was flattened. The bomb left nothing.
Except, I suspect, the archive section. Indeed, many sections of the underground city were designed to survive the impact of a 10-megaton overblast.
But then the tapes and pictures of my parents...
are still down there.
Oh. Oh, MacDonald. I want to see what they look like. Yeah, I suppose every orphan does. I want to hear what they thought and knew.
The city's radioactive.
Oh, yeah, well, let me see. Who is there among your people who knows something about radioactivity?
No one.
And among mine?
Who knows everything about everything?
Oh, Virgil. He's going to find him.
The plan to go back to the Forbidden City is set into action. Caesar's eagerness to see and hear his parents seems to undermine his realization of the danger involved in such an adventure. Only one person seems to truly realize what the ramifications of such a journey could be, and Lisa wastes no time in telling her husband of her anxieties.
Lisa, you remember your parents?
I was too young when they died to remember mine.
Look, I don't want to have to remember my husband. I want to love him now.
No, Virgil will be with us. Now we'll take good care.
Say goodbye to Cornelius. I don't want him to know I'm afraid.
Cornelius.
Father.
I'm going on a journey.
What will you bring me back?
What would you like?
More nuts for my squirrel. He's going fast.
So are you. One day you will be as tall as a king.
I must mention here in a side note that Roddy's performance as the father of a young child in this movie is incredibly endearing, and gives McDowell fans an insight into what sort of a father Roddy would have been had he ever married and had children in his personal life. It shows a greater depth to his softness and nurturing qualities, which one doesn't usually get to see in other films in which he starred. The Apes films are indeed the only movies in which Roddy ever portrayed a husband and father, and in all four films, he portrayed these father figures and kings with such depth of understanding and compassion that he brings the roles of Cornelius and Caesar even more sympathy than the characters would have garnered had they not both been the loving and devoted family men, or apes, they were. After saying goodbye to his son, Caesar, Virgil, and Bruce all go to see Mandemus, the keeper of the armory in the village.
Mandemus.
Who's there?
Caesar.
What does Caesar want?
Weapons.
For what purpose?
For self-protection in the pursuit of knowledge.
Self-protection against whom or what?
We don't know.
Well, then what is the point of protecting yourself against a danger of which you have no knowledge, in pursuit of a knowledge you do not possess?
Is it a knowledge for good or evil?
All knowledge is for good. Only the use to which you put it can be good or evil.
Well put.
Thank you.
The sun is rising. I should like to get this matter settled before it sets.
Caesar has appointed me not only as the keeper of this armory, but as the keeper of his own conscience. That is why I have asked 6 boring questions, and now propose to ask a 7th before issuing, or not issuing, the weapons you require. What is the nature of the knowledge you cannot seek without weapons?
The knowledge of Earth's ultimate fate recorded on tapes in the archives of the Forbidden City.
Which is contaminated, but still may be inhabited by humans.
Come in.
Satisfied with the answers he has been given by the trio, Mandemus opens the doors to the armory and allows the two apes and their human companion to enter. They choose three submachine guns, ammunition, a Geiger counter, and one pistol for MacDonald, who has been given permission to shoot, cook, and eat a rabbit over the three-day journey. Once receiving their arms and exiting the armory, MacDonald comments that though Mandemus is old, he has a mind as sharp as a razor. Virgil replies that Mandemus was his teacher when he was a boy. Caesar then ushers the two forward, anxious to leave the village before sunrise. The journey to the Forbidden City has begun, and over a period of approximately 2 minutes, we see the trio complete their three-day journey into the ruins of the long-forgotten city. When they reach the horizon, Caesar announces,
"There it is, or was,
like a storm at sea, but solidified
by a bomb from an armory 1,000 times the size of ours.
And nobody to keep its owner's conscience."
The land around the Forbidden City is now a desert wasteland, surrounded by tangled metal from the melted buildings. MacDonald quips, "This is the hell my forefathers used to speak about." The melted city truly does resemble what one might imagine a city in hell to look like after the flames had melted everything. Nothing has any shape or order. It is all charred, colorless, piled haphazardly in a heap on dunes of shifting sand, and pitifully. Entering the destroyed subway entrance, Virgil asks MacDonald if he is aware of where they are. He announces that where they are standing now was 11th Avenue, and that two blocks west of them on the corner of Breck and Ackerman Streets lies the archive section. Their destination close by, the trio depart for the western section of the city. Little do they know, two blocks east of them, in what used to be the Ape Management Building, is a group of radiation-poisoning infected humans who survived the nuclear explosion at the end of the Great War. Among them, now named Governor, is Culp, who had been Governor Breck's top hatchet man during the time of Caesar's enslavement. Culp and his band of mutated humans are now living in boredom within the confines of their radioactive prison, with nothing to do but salvage parts from the ruins of the buildings around them. Or, as Culp mentions to his fellow inmate Alma, put some flesh on the bones of the ghost city. Meanwhile, Caesar, Virgil, and Bruce are getting closer to the archive section, but the radiation levels are climbing to dangerous proportions. They are unaware, however, that they are being closely monitored by security sensors on the wall as they get closer to their destination. They trigger the warning bell in the section of F6, and Culp informs his security officer, Mendez, that there may be intruders in the proximity. They go to watch the last remaining surveillance cameras in the city and catch their intruders entering the archive section. Culp instantly recognizes them.
"This is the place."
"Caesar, come back to reconquer his kingdom.
Doesn't he know that the bomb did that?"
As they inch closer and closer to where the tapes containing the footage of Cornelius and Zira are kept, the Geiger counter in Virgil's hands keeps sizzling more rapidly. Stopping for a moment to check the readings, Virgil announces to the stationary group that they are still all right, and they proceed forward. Culp, meanwhile, is aggressively searching the video camera for more eyes on Caesar. The ape's presence in the city is unsettling to him. He announces that he recognizes MacDonald, but doesn't know the orangutan, and then, thinking aloud, announces to Alma,
"Archives, we haven't been in there since, I wonder what the devil they want in there."
"Now, we find the tape that we're looking for under the heading of Presidential Commission."
"Proceedings of the Presidential Commission on Alien Visitors, 1973. Is this it?"
"Let's see. Yes, that's it. Now, if this thing works, the picture should come out on that screen over there."
"All security forces alert. All security forces alert. Check out all sections and areas M5. Apprehend three strangers you will find there. One human and two apes. But caution. I repeat, caution. If they resist, you may shoot. But shoot to maim. We want them alive for interrogation.
If we shoot, we break 12 years of peace.
Yes, it has been rather boring, hasn't it?
My mother.
Who won your war?
It wasn't our war. It was the guerrillas' war.
The date meet on the spaceship. What did it read after Earth's destruction?
3950.
And you talk to your pupils about eternity.
There are only three.
There must be more. The question is how many?
That's the question we'll have answered when we get them.
My father. That's my father.
How did apes first acquire the power of speech?
They learned to refuse. On a historic day, there came an ape who spoke a word which had been spoken to him time without number by humans. He said, no.
The mutants are now silently moving in on the group of knowledge seekers. Virgil, noticing the surveillance camera moving, shoots and destroys it. Alma, who is at the control panel, informs Governor Culp of this. Culp says he is disinterested in equipment failures, but Alma assures him it was in fact not an equipment failure, but deliberate destruction. Together, the trio leaves the archive chamber, Bruce announcing their need to find another way out of the catacombs. Virgil asks if such a way exists. Meanwhile, the mutants, still quietly searching, receive orders from Governor Culp. No longer does he want the troops to merely shoot to maim, he has now given the order to kill. Working at top speed, the leader of the search party orders for his men to follow, and they move out, with him ordering them to hurry and run. None of the troops seem in a great hurry to pick up speed, however. As they walk through the catacombs seeking another exit, deathly ill mutants who are lying in makeshift beds along the corners of the pipeways reach out towards Caesar, Bruce, and Virgil as though begging for help. Some of the mutant goons are hiding among the sick and the dying, and suddenly one jumps down and waylays Virgil. With the help of Caesar and MacDonald, he manages to break free and the trio escapes up the pipeline. Running out of the archives corridor, they come to a stairwell blocked fast by mutants. Culp, who has been watching over remaining surveillance cameras, announces to his troops that they are successfully escaping and must be killed. Hearing this pronouncement over the loudspeaker, the trio takes up refuge under the pipeline. Realizing they are now in the ducts of the old ape management building, Caesar, seeing an armed mutant nearing them with a look of resolved intent to murder spread over his face, reaches down and picks up the nozzle of a fire hose resting against the panel they are hiding behind. Giving Virgil the signal, the water stream is pulled open, and the mutants are sent flying with the brute force of the barrage, which is now engulfing them completely. Caesar, pleased with his ingenuity, grins in triumph. MacDonald, seeing an exit in the roof above them, opens the trap door, and the three escape via the roof of the pipeline into a further section of the old ape management building. However, one of Culp's goons is getting closer. Remembering they have grenades, Caesar and MacDonald pull the pins from their weapons and toss them into the stairway, diverting the attention of the goons. This gives them just enough headway to successfully exit the building and run out into the open rubble of the Forbidden City's melted streets. They are now safe and have fled the city for home, much to Culp's intense displeasure.
You knew every bolt and nut in those corridors. You have 100 armed men. How could you let them escape?
They were fast and smart, Governor Culp. Many of my men were sick, and the chimp surprised us.
Yeah, he surprised me too once. But he's an animal. He's only an animal.
No, Governor. He's more than an animal. He can speak. So can they all.
So speech makes them human?
Speech makes them intelligent. And intelligence may make them not human, but humane. Perhaps they came in peace.
Oh, idiot, they were armed.
From what we saw on the monitor, only for their self-protection. Let them return in peace.
To where?
To wherever they live.
So that they can come back here and exterminate those of us that the bomb has not already exterminated? Where do they live?
They came with few provisions. It can't be too far.
Which way did they head?
They headed north, Governor.
Organize scout parties. Assemble workable equipment and follow them to their camp.
Yes, Governor Culp. Why, Governor?
So that we can exterminate them.
Holding an obvious grudge from the years past before the Great War, Culp wants nothing more than to see the end of Caesar, and he wants it to be a bloody one. His troops assembling, he makes his battle plans. The trio is now returning to the ape village. It is in the early morning hours just after dawn, and the village seems to be peaceful. Suddenly, Caesar is grabbed from behind by a gorilla sentry.
It's Caesar!
What a welcome! We should have stayed in the city.
To visit the city is forbidden.
I know. I forbade it.
Then why?
Aldo, if a king forbids his subjects to wear a crown, that doesn't mean he can't wear one himself. Caesar is Caesar. He went to the city for a reason.
What reason?
I went looking for my past, but I found our future.
Explain.
You wouldn't understand.
Otto will make the future. With this.
Well then, Aldo may very soon be in the past.
Aldo's choosing to wield a knife in Caesar's face proves to Caesar that the gorilla has a blatant death wish, and whatever tiny shreds of respect he had left, if any, for the gorilla, have now completely vanished. The trio turn their backs on the gorillas and return home, laughing at Aldo's foolishness. In the village, we see Cornelius playing with a small boy. They are pretending to be at war. The small human boy playing the hunter, and Cornelius the prey. Shouting out in pain and throwing himself on the ground as though shot, Cornelius startles Lisa, who comes out of the house to see that her son's cries do not signal danger. The little boy, still pretending to stalk his fictitious prey, closes in from behind a tree, wielding a long, thin stick to portray the rifle. Just as he begins to walk up to Cornelius, Lisa approaches her son, lying on the ground.
Cornelius, are you all right?
No, Mother. I'm just dead.
Dead?
We were playing war.
War? Cornelius, hasn't your father explained to you that war is not a game?
Yes, Mother.
And hasn't he also forbidden you to play with guns?
Yes, Mother.
Then you'll stop it.
Yes, Mother.
Now come along. Father wants us.
As Lisa and Cornelius return to their treehouse, a group of three mutants sneak into the outskirts of the village with binoculars, spying into the ape camp. Having discovered where the apes live, they creep closer to gather as much information as possible for Governor Culp. As they look through the spyglass, they see a gathering of the apes in the mountainous section of the village. This is the council meeting place. Atop a hill is a rock throne, which is bookended on either side by two wooden chairs. These are the seats of the royal family, and Lisa and Cornelius are sitting in the chairs on either side of Caesar as he takes his throne. The apes below are gathering in their usual segregated form. The gorillas have chosen to sit together in the center of the council clearing. The orangutans have chosen to sit themselves on the hill facing Lisa, and the chimpanzees on the far left corner facing Cornelius. Seeing that everyone is in their respective seats and prepared to listen, Caesar begins to speak.
My friends, I have convened this extraordinary meeting of the council in order that I may report upon an action which I deemed necessary. A reconnaissance expedition to the Forbidden City.
With Virgil and MacDonald as my aides.
Why MacDonald? Why not a soldier?
Because we went in peace to what we thought would be a dead city. But in case there were some survivors, we took MacDonald with us so that he could parley with them and secure permission for our search.
Survivors there are. Maimed. Mutated. Hostile. And human.
Did the humans follow you here?
We saw no sign of it. But we must prepare for the day when they may come out of the city.
When they may come to find us.
No humans in council. No humans in council.
They are here because I sent for them. Now that we know the danger, we need their help and their counsel.
No.
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 Yes!
No.
Come. We shall not sit in council with humans.
No. Now, let us reason together and make plans.
Meanwhile, in the remains of ape management in the Forbidden City, Culp's right-hand man is begging him to see reason and abandon his campaign for bloodshed. But Culp is disinterested in peace, and wants only war. Perhaps this is driven out of sheer boredom, or perhaps it is driven by madness from radiation poisoning, or perhaps even still, it is born out of a hatred for Caesar, which has lain dormant for years since the end of the Great War and the beginning of the time when the apes took power. Whatever it was born out of, it still spelled the same thing. Trouble. Alma, suddenly coming running from the far corner of the room, announces that the captain has returned. The captain announces to Culp that they have found the Ape City. Showing Culp a hand-drawn map of the area, the captain explains the locations of the gorilla outpost, as well as the orchard and vineyards, which provide the community its nourishment, and finally, the location of the main village itself. Culp, inquiring whether the city can be taken, is informed by the captain that it is of a size that their troops will be able to handle. He then asks if the captain was seen, to which he answers Caesar was too busy with a council of war to notice them peeking in from the outskirts of the encampment. The captain informs Culp that soon Caesar will be coming for them, to which Culp answers that Caesar will not have the time to do so, as they will be coming for him. Now. Back at the Ape City, Lisa entreats Caesar not to go through with his plans for war.
Caesar, on the night of the fires, you swore an oath that in the future, apes and humans would live together in kindness and peace. Why are you now making every sort of preparation to break that oath?
Because, unlike the humans in our city, those in the Forbidden City are mad. Mad enough not to want peace and friendship, but enmity and war.
Did they tell you that?
Oh, yes. Yes. By opening fire on us without giving us a chance to explain.
You were trespassing on their territory.
But, Lisa, we didn't know the city was inhabited.
But how, if you didn't speak to them, do you know its inhabitants are mad?
Oh, Lisa, you didn't see them. They're, They're malformed.
Like the freaks in your foster father's circus? Were they mad?
What's malformed?
Cornelius, go to bed.
And I'll give Ricky his water.
Lisa, freaks are different. These humans are the end product of nuclear radiation. They're mutants. And they're mad.
Caesar is not willing to risk the safety of his people within the village, ape and human alike, for the sake of maintaining peace. Though war is not something he craves, he understands what Culp is capable of, having seen the madness spreading in him even as far back as the night of the fires. He knows that Culp poses a threat, and he knows his followers will not think twice before spilling blood. They proved in the attack under the Forbidden City just that morning that they always would shoot first and ask questions later. In the bowels of Ape Management, Culp has now requisitioned vehicles for the journey to Ape City. The mutants have rebuilt the engine for a school bus, and Culp has made a sort of a makeshift assault tank out of a military jeep. Giving the orders to move out when the bus is finished being repaired, Culp moves out and begins his plans for his full-scale assault on Caesar City. With Culp riding at the head of the convoy, two jury-rigged jeep tanks and 70-plus mutants join ranks and form a marching line. Left behind are Mendez and Alma, looking on in terror. Back in Caesar's home, Cornelius, who is asleep, hears his pet squirrel Ricky escape from his cage. Following after the squirrel in an attempt to retrieve him, Cornelius stumbles upon a fireside meeting, being held by General Aldo with his guerrilla troops. He is preaching treason against Caesar. Climbing up into a tree to get a better look, Cornelius sees Aldo signing to his guerrilla army as he speaks out loud exactly his plans for dethroning their king.
We need power. Guns. 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 Power. We shall get them and we shall keep them. With guns, we will smash the humans. All humans. And then... we will smash Caesar!
Shocked at the pronouncement from Aldo that his ultimate desire is to smash Caesar, the gorillas temporarily freeze. Suddenly, one of them looks up and spies Cornelius in the tree. He calls Aldo's attention to the child.
Look!
And Aldo stands to spy the boy with his own eyes.
Caesar's son!
And he overheard every word we said.
Cornelius! Come down! Come down, or else.
Realizing that he is in terrible danger, Cornelius refuses to move and stays on his branch in the tree. Silent and paralyzed with fear, Aldo, taking matters into his own hands, climbs the tree, chasing after Cornelius, who is climbing onto different branches in an attempt to escape. Finally, Cornelius climbs onto a weak branch higher up in the tree. Aldo, seeing the child is now cornered, climbs up, his sword unsheathed, and begins trying to chop down the branch on which a terrified Cornelius is crouching. As a result, Cornelius, terrified, whimpers for his father. Meanwhile, Lisa has discovered her son is missing and is calling for him in the house. Seconds later, Aldo successfully cuts through the branch, and Cornelius screams. As he falls to the ground, Lisa hears his cries and comes running into the clearing, where the gorillas are gathered around Cornelius. The apes disperse at Aldo's order and hide just moments before Lisa finds her son, lying unconscious and wounded on the ground.
Cornelius!
It is now dawn, and Kolb's troops have reached the outskirts of the Forbidden City on their way to meet the apes. The buses joined the convoy, and the troops have gained more numbers. One of the vehicles has issues with its motor, and a mutant stays behind to repair it. Simultaneous to the mutant's approach on the Ape City, McDonald is investigating the clearing where Cornelius was found. A group of three apes, two chimpanzees and an orangutan that we haven't been formally introduced to, are talking among themselves about the incident. One chimpanzee announces that he had only heard about it that morning, and that the squirrel is missing. He mentions that perhaps Cornelius was climbing in the trees to find him. The female chimpanzee next to him inquires on Cornelius's condition, to which the male replies that he is badly hurt. McDonald, meanwhile, discovers the ashes and sticks from the bonfire and sees the branch from which Cornelius fell. He can instantly tell that the branch was cut and comes to the realization that it was no accident. Pulling the branch down, he investigates it close up, discovering the notches made in the bark from Aldo's sword. Back in Caesar's home, Cornelius's condition is worsening. He is being watched over mournfully by his parents and Julie. Julie walks up to the bed, where Cornelius is whimpering in pain and burning up from fever. She takes his temperature as Lisa and Caesar watch over their son, their eyes never wavering from his bed. Julie, upset from the boy's piteous condition, walks outside of the hut and is followed by Lisa, who seeks her counsel. She asks her to speak the truth, to which she can only reply, "Even if we had a hospital," and trails off, implying that there is nothing to be done. Things are looking bleak for Caesar's son, and the future of apekind. Not wishing to deter her husband's unending hope, Lisa announces that she is not going to tell Caesar about Cornelius just yet, as he still feels he can change the future. Meanwhile, the mutants are approaching faster and faster as Cornelius's condition worsens. They have now reached the outskirts of the city and have passed the gorilla's outpost. The two sentries posted at the gate kill a mutant on board a motorcycle, which results in their being fired upon by Kolb's bazooka. Thinking both gorillas are dead, the mutant troops carry on, but there is one survivor. Knowing the importance of warning the Ape City, the gorilla crawls, helplessly injured on all fours, towards the city in the hopes of reaching Aldo. The main concern in the Ape City at present, however, is little Cornelius. Virgil updates McDonald on the young chimp's status.
The doctor is doing her best. I don't believe Cornelius can live. Caesar does. He refuses to leave his side. McDonald, how can a benevolent god allow the branch of one of his own trees to crack and injure an innocent child?
It didn't crack, Virgil. It was cut.
Order at council! Order! Order! The humans are attacking! They have killed one gorilla, and they have wounded another. Kill them.
We were scouting desert approaches to the city and saw their army. They fired. My companion was killed. I have come to warn you.
And how long before they get here?
Soon. So now we must prepare. Take the humans out. Lock them all in the corral.
Aldo! Aldo! You can't do this! You're acting against Caesar's orders!
Caesar is not here.
After his shocking pronouncement, Aldo brazenly sits on Caesar's throne at the head of the council clearing. In his mind, he has declared himself king, and he is going to use the war with the mutants to overthrow his most hated monarch. One by one, the gorillas begin rounding up the humans and locking them in the corral, removing them bodily and forcibly from their everyday routines. This results in a shockwave, which resonates throughout the city as men, women, and children who are unaware of what has just transpired are taken by surprise and imprisoned merely for being human. Virgil watches in horror as this takes place and attempts to sneak off to inform Caesar, but he is caught by Aldo, who tries to stop him.
Mandamus!
Who's there?
Aldo! General Aldo!
What do you want?
Guns! Guns!
What will you do with them?
We shall do with them what we will.
Do what you will is the devil's law.
Who are you, Mandamus? God?
I am the keeper of Caesar's country.
And I am the keeper of Caesar's army.
Under allegiance to Caesar. Where is he?
Mandamus, as I speak, our city is being attacked by humans from without and within. Who cares where Caesar is?
I care. There is a law that weapons may only be issued from this armory under direct orders from Caesar, and not under threats from one of his thicker-headed subordinates for whom war means only personal glory. Now find me Caesar. I will listen to him.
First, listen to this. Get every gun in the place. Everything. Get the ammo boxes. Get the handgun. Grenades.
Stop! Stop! Caesar forbids you!
Now taken captive and the armory raided, Mandamus is helpless against the onslaught of guerrilla warfare. The mutant army has now arrived and is inside the Ape City boundaries. Culp gives the orders that when they leave, he wants the Ape City to look just like the Forbidden City. He wants absolutely nothing left alive. The troops need to assemble their weapons and prepare to move into the city itself. Virgil, having snuck out of his home while Aldo and his cronies raided Mandamus's armory, has entered Caesar's home and silently announces himself with a low bow to his king. Caesar sees him and rises from his seat by Cornelius's bed. It is now the very early hours of the morning, and both parents have been watching their son all night. Caesar is weary, but realizes Virgil would not have come if it weren't important. Silently, he greets his advisor.
Caesar, forgive me, but I couldn't get here before now. Aldo has seized power. He's broken into the armory and imprisoned all humans in the corral.
MacDonald.
He was dragged from the council meeting by Aldo's guerrillas.
I can't leave Cornelius. He needs me.
Every ape and human in Ape City needs you. Now.
I think you should go to Cornelius.
Father, they hurt me. They want to hurt you.
Who hurt you? The humans?
No.
Then who?
Shall I be malformed?
No. One day, you are going to be as tall as a king.
Comforted by his father's pronouncement, Cornelius closes his eyes and slowly falls into death, as gently as though he were falling asleep. Realizing their son has died, Caesar and Lisa both begin to sob, burying their heads into their son's chest to weep. Now fully prepared for battle and prepping their weapons, the mutants receive their last orders from Culp and begin to march, as Caesar and Lisa mourn the death of their son. Caesar asks Virgil what Cornelius's last pronouncements mean.
He said they hurt him. Who? Who would hurt him?
I think you'll have your answer, and soon.
What do you know?
That's what I know!
Eyes burning with fury, Caesar surveys the makeshift prison containing the humans who had lived in peace in the city for many years, looking back at him through the slats in the corral, their eyes full of tears, bewilderment, and confusion. Incensed by this atrocity, Caesar confronts Aldo.
You did this!
For security.
Did you also raid the armory for the same reason?
For security!
Caesar! Caesar!
I order you to stop this! I order you to stop it now and release those people!
See? Aldo was right! War has come! Let's go!
The barrage of firing on the city has begun, and Caesar must think fast in order to protect his people. They have been blindsided by the attack, though Caesar was expecting it to come. He had not expected it to come now. As the mutants commence firing on the city, the humans trapped in Aldo's cage scream in fear as the gorillas launch an attack force. Caesar, keeping his head, starts gathering all the apes in the village and calling them to run to safety.
Go to the barricade! Come on! Go to the barricade!
Hell has come to the ape city. Bombs are falling all around as gunfire breaks out on all sides. Caesar has joined in the fighting, taking up arms alongside Virgil, as all ape classes build up the barricade around the city.
They're laying a smoke screen! Here they come! Where's Aldo? Probably the other side of the valley by now.
Explosions begin leaving craters in the ground around the ape city as the mutants continue with the fire from all around, creeping closer and closer to their prey. Culp's desire to make a wasteland of the ape city, as Caesar had done to his, seems to be coming to fruition. Caesar realizes that they are outmanned and outgunned and calls the retreat. Casualties begin falling in ape ranks as the humans drive through the barricade, continuing their fire. Treehouses are blown up when hit by bazooka fire. Inside Caesar's home, Julie begs Lisa to leave, telling her that she cannot remain there any longer, and she must save herself. Lisa sits quietly, still watching the corpse of her son, who has now lain dead for hours. Now in the heart of the village, the mutant troops cease firing and stop their vehicles. Culp leaves his jeep and begins walking around its perimeter. Strewn around him on the ground are dozens of ape corpses, gorillas, chimpanzees, and orangutans all lying haphazardly on the ground. Fruit carts have been overturned from the market, and there are oranges scattered around on the ground beside some of the bodies. Silence has fallen.
Caesar. Your people weakened our city by rebelling against your human masters. But we who survive will create a new race. And you and yours will be brought low. And you shall learn again what it is to have a master. Learning already.
Clever ape.
Oh no.
Ape. Clever ape.
But then you always were clever. I was told how you chose your own name. But every Caesar must have his Brutus. Did you know that? Ape.
Do you understand that, ape?
And now Ape City is about to lose its king.
No, Colt, no!
Now, fight like apes!
Suddenly, the bodies of what appear to be dead apes rise from the ground, take up their arms, and begin fighting pell-mell with the surprised mutant humans. Culp had assumed that he had gained the upper hand by driving smack into the heart of the city, but he had forgotten exactly how clever Caesar truly was. Nets drop on the mutants from various places in the trees, trapping the mutants beneath them. Some apes become slightly more enthusiastic in their desire to take the mutants down, and start beating the mutants' heads in with sticks, but Caesar stops them.
Stop! Stop! No killing! Take them captive!
Culp, proving himself a coward, boards the bus with two or three other mutants and gives the order for the driver to get going. He is thinking he can simply escape the battle he has now lost and be none the worse for running away. The gorillas have rounded up the remaining mutants in the back of their own jeep and are planning to exterminate them. Caesar again intervenes.
No, don't kill them! Take them prisoner!
Seeing the school bus beginning to drive away, Virgil takes aim, only to be stopped by Caesar.
No, Virgil.
Tired and forlorn, Caesar and Virgil look around their wounded city. Trees and the houses that once rested on their branches are now burning, unable to be saved. Relenting to the reality around them, Caesar urges.
All right, Virgil. Let's go.
Caesar is willing to let Culp escape, beaten and uninjured, except for his pride. He feels it is a good enough lesson for Culp to have learned, therefore never to be a threat again. But Aldo's followers, furious for being attacked, are not going to let him leave. A few feet outside of the city, the bus is surrounded by Aldo and his followers. Shouting, "No prisoners!" Aldo leads an assault on the bus, out for blood. Breaking the windows, the gorillas all fire inside the bus, killing all inside, including Culp. Back in the now limping city, the triumphant apes who are loyal to Caesar are all bowing, celebrating, and crying, "Hail Caesar!" as he re-enters his city. Raising his hands for silence among the cheers, the apes quiet down in reverence, and Caesar says,
"Let the humans go, Virgil. All of them.
No!
They stay. Aldo says what we do now.
They have done nothing. They shall go free.
You like humans? You want them out of the corral? All right. Kill them! Kill them! Kill them all!
Stop! Stop! No more killing, Aldo. Put down your weapons. Take them back to the armory.
No! We shall keep the guns. Move, Caesar, or we shall kill you.
Ape has never killed ape, let alone an ape child. Aldo has killed an ape child. The branch did not break. It was cut with a sword.
Aldo. You. You kill.
Aldo killed.
Aldo has broken our most sacred law. Our child. He killed our child.
What's the matter with them? I guess you might say they just joined the human race.
Ape has killed ape. Ape has killed ape. Ape has killed ape. Ape has killed ape.
Aldo, beginning to see the full fury he has brought down upon himself from the ape community, knows what is coming. As Caesar looks him dead in the eyes and growls angrily in unison to the chance of ape has killed ape, Aldo climbs up into the nearest tree, hoping to escape his king's rage. Caesar slowly follows him, resolved in what he must do. Reaching the very top of the tree, Aldo and Caesar face one another, Aldo shaking his head in fear of Caesar, as Caesar pronounces,
"You murdered my son. You murdered my son. You murdered my son."
Hissing with rage, Caesar prepares to attack as Aldo unsheathes his sword, thinking to fight back. But nothing can cap the boundless rage within the bereaved father of a murdered child, and when Monarch and General go head to head, it is Aldo who loses the fight, falling to his death, just as Cornelius fell at his hand.
Should one murder be avenged by another?
Only the future can tell. So let us start building it.
Aldo now dead, Caesar is no longer blocked from freeing the humans whom he releases from their prison right away. They all stand in a circle, looking at him with mixed reactions on their faces. Some serious, some are afraid.
If we appear to be lacking in gratitude, Caesar, what have we to be grateful for? If you mean to set us free, then free us completely.
What do you mean?
We are not your children, Caesar. We have a destiny too.
As equals, respecting each other, living together with love.
Love. The human way is violence and death.
Aldo wasn't human. Was he, Caesar?
Virgil,
you are a good and wise ape.
And you, Caesar, are a good and wise king.
Realizing that Lisa, Virgil, and MacDonald are right, Caesar releases the humans from their bondage, as MacDonald had asked, completely. And together, ape and mankind begin making plans to rebuild their fallen city.
We'll rebuild what's ruined and begin again. Tell me something, MacDonald. Can we make the future what we wish?
I've heard that it's possible, Caesar.
Every weapon is back in its proper place. Caesar, I want to ask a favor. This armory's been my home for 27 years.
You may live in it for the rest of your days.
But I don't want to live in it. Oh, no. Now that the danger is over, I want to see it destroyed, blown up. The greatest danger of all is that danger never ends.
And so, Mandemus, we must be patient and wait.
We still wait, my children. But as I look at apes and humans living in friendship, harmony, and the peace, now some 600 years after Caesar's death, at least we wait with hope for the future.
Nah, Gibber, who knows about the future?
Perhaps only the dead.
At the lawgiver's last statement, the camera pans in to a statue depicting Caesar, which we see shedding a tear out of its left eye. Is the statue crying because the humans have now come to live in peace and harmony with the apes? Or is it shedding tears because Caesar's last true desires for a peaceful life where both can live together in love and friendship was never meant to be? None can say for certain, and the answer would never come. The battle for the planet of the apes was won, and the saga had now come to a close. The production began filming on January 2, 1973, with a budget of $1.8 million. Battle was meant to be geared directly towards children, after the increased violence of conquest. The producers were hoping to keep the attraction to the family audience in the foreground of the story. Paul Dane had originally hoped that the cast for Battle would be made up of all the main cast members from Conquest. Roddy McDowall and Natalie Trundy both returned, reprising their roles as Caesar and Lisa.
For me, it was back to the makeup chair for another chance to play Caesar. I was anxious to do it because I'd enjoyed the role even more than I had the part of Cornelius.
They also brought in Bobby Porter, who would play Caesar's son, Cornelius. Porter would later go on to play a bit part in a short-lived science fiction TV series, which Roddy would soon co-star in, called The Fantastic Journey, in 1977. reporter, standing at 4 feet 10 inches tall, was 21 at the time he portrayed Cornelius, who was supposed to be much younger, perhaps 11 or 12 years old. Don Murray, who played Governor Breck, and Harry Rhodes, who played Mr. McDonald, were also approached to return, but both refused. The character of McDonald was important to the storyline, however, so the scriptwriters creatively changed it from being the McDonald from Conquest and made the character McDonald's brother. Austin Stoker was then cast in the role. With the absence of a villain now causing a difficulty since Don Murray was not interested in returning, the writers asked Severn Darden, who portrayed Inspector Culp, if he was interested. He was, and agreed to reprise his role from the previous film. He was therefore written into the script as the integral villain for the main storyline.
The story focused on the ape leader, Caesar, just a few years after he has led the ape revolution. An off-screen nuclear war has occurred, and Caesar now rules over a surviving band of apes and humans. The two species have forged a fragile coexistence. The apes are also working with the humans to educate themselves, and have begun forming their own laws. In keeping with Jacob's new concept, Caesar's character was softened.
Cornelius.
He is no longer militant and angry.
Cornelius.
But patient and benevolent. Natalie Trundy again signed on to play my wife, Lisa. This was the fourth apes film for both of us. Some carefully placed rubble and a clever matte painting created the illusion of a bombed-out Forbidden City, where a group of radiation-scarred humans continue to live. For the interior of the Forbidden City, the producers used the Hyperion Water Treatment Plant located in Los Angeles. Another interesting casting note, the orangutan Virgil, was played by singer-songwriter Paul Williams. When the humans from the Forbidden City launch an attack, Caesar is caught in a political power struggle with the commander of the military, General Aldo, played by the noted character actor Claude Akins. Like all the entries in the series, Battle for the Planet of the Apes contained plenty of rousing action sequences.
Now, fight like apes!
Near the film's conclusion, the mutant humans are defeated. But the action is tempered by a much more pacifistic tone than in previous apes films. Caesar also discovers that Aldo is responsible for the death of his son. And one final battle for the planet of the apes is fought.
Ape City, where Caesar's new civilization of apes lived, was filmed, like the first Apes installment, at Malibu Creek State Park. Battle for the Planet of the Apes, like its predecessors, did well at the box office, grossing $4,864,355 during the weeks of June 17th and June 24th, 1973. The wardrobe from this film were the outfits from the three prequels, separating the ape classes by color. The chimpanzees being dressed in forest green with chocolate brown leather collars, the orangutans in orange molded leather, and the gorillas in burgundy coats with black leather trim. The apes have also now gained the abilities to read, write, and speak fluent English. This is not explained in the film, but it is generally assumed the costumes were reused due to the tiny budget the production was given by the studio. Battle for the Planet of the Apes premiered in May of 1973. The film now released, and yet another smash hit at the box office, producer Arthur P. Jacobs died of a heart attack at the age of 51 years old, just days after the film's premiere. Roddy McDowall said in an interview in 1981 about the movies, "Apes are wonderful characters and an enormous acting challenge. Our apes are perfectly adorable and terribly sweet people, but a little bizarre." Some ape characters, indeed, were bizarre, and bizarre characters would continue to be invented even still when the television series was launched in September of 1974. Once again, Roddy was cast in the leading role, this time playing Galen, an assistant to Dr. Zaius, who becomes a fugitive while helping two astronauts in their journey to return home. The show was mildly successful, but lacked the steam and creative talent it needed to keep the storyline fresh and consistent, and it was canceled after 14 episodes. Roddy's makeup application to transform into Galen took even less time than it did to transform into Cornelius and Caesar. Where in the beginning it took 5 hours, then later 4, it now only took 3. Once the makeups were applied, it limited the actor's ability to eat, drink, and favored above all for McDowell, smoke. Roddy was a chain smoker and was forced to use an extra long cigarette holder in order to enjoy his unhealthy vice. While asked by Smash Magazine about the makeup in 1974, Roddy admitted that it wasn't entirely pleasant. Well, you get very hot. And not only that, but as the day wears on, you don't get enough oxygen to your skin. It's somewhat disturbing. I have a marvelous makeup man, Freddy Blau, who puts a lot of stuff on my face to protect it. And then we made a deal when I came to do this series that the makeup can be on my face only a certain number of hours a day. Having had experience with the films beforehand, I know where the exhaustion point is. When the makeups have been on about 10 hours, you start to get really bugged. Even so, I enjoy the reality of the appliance. It's really very effective. The effectiveness to which Roddy referred was in regards to how the costumes bring the ape characters to life for the actors portraying them, as mentioned in the previous show by Kim Hunter from their experience on Escape from the Planet of the Apes. Without the appliances, part of the characters were lost, and the actors were unable to regain their original performances without the costumes. According to Leslie Salisbury, who interviewed Roddy in the 1977 article entitled The Million Dollar Face, Roddy's experiences on the set were rather arduous. Salisbury says, "The films were hard work. He spent 11 hours a day glued into the rubber mask makeup and hairy costume, working on locations that sent his body heat soaring. After 5 days of almost continuous wear, the mask would cause his skin to break out in a rash. His face was insured for $1 million. No one knew what lasting damage could be done to the skin," McDowell commented. "Once, I stayed in the mask for 19 hours and nearly collapsed with the heat and exhaustion. I had a cyst on my head caused by the dirt from the wig." This was not the first time Roddy had suffered from cysts, however. He also suffered from them during battle. As well as suffering from a terrible cold during battle, Roddy developed 3 small cysts on his face from continual application and removal of the ape makeups. The cysts were painful for him, and he had to have the cysts surgically removed. "I tended to forget the discomfort," Roddy said. 8 months or more would pass between these films, and I didn't quite remember how wearing they really were. I had to report for work at 5 o'clock in the morning to spend a little under 4 hours in the makeup chair being transformed into a chimpanzee. But that's not the main thing that bothered me. I'm not a true claustrophobe, but after a time, not being able to scratch my nose, eat anything, or drink except through a straw really works on my nerves. After 5 hours, I really became a basket case. Despite being uncomfortable in the makeups and occasionally being mocked by onlookers not associated with the productions, Roddy treasured his time being a chimpanzee for the films. "The parts are good, and there's the challenge of communicating through the appliances. They're not literally masks. I think that's why we have had so many fine actors in the pictures. They like the challenge. Masks are in the oldest tradition of the theater. And there is something exciting about reviving an ancient art." Ancient art transcended to modern-day artistic spectacle is partially what brought the films in the Apes franchise the magic they possess even today, 50 years after the first film's release in 1968. The political themes in the films remain fresh and, sadly, are still relevant today. Years later, after the passing of the Civil Rights Act, racism, prejudice, hatred and bigotry still poison the minds and hearts of humanity. Perhaps the truth behind the tear running down the face of the statue of Caesar was not because he had either succeeded or failed in his quest to bring peace to humans and apes alike, but was rather an allegorical picture of what modern-day society would soon become. Perhaps the stories from Planet of the Apes were not only meant to teach us love and compassion, but to also show humanity one of its most unalterable flaws: that we have never truly learned from our mistakes, and burying our history, only repeat them, and are doomed to continue repeating them till the end of the world as we know it is brought about by our own foolishness. Who can truly say? Perhaps Cornelius, Zira, and finally Caesar, did. That's all for this episode of Not Just Yesterday, the Roddy McDowell Podcast. Thank you for listening. I hope you will join me for my next episode, which will air on September 17th. in celebration of Roddy's 90th birthday. This is Zoe Dean signing off, reminding you once again, dear friends, to keep smiling.
You seem to bring faraway spring near me. I'm always in full bloom when you're in the room, for every night at 7. Every time the same thing happens, I fall once again in love, but only with you.
Every night about 7.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Not Just Yesterday, the Roddy McDowell Podcast. The podcast is hosted, written, edited, and produced by Zoe Dean. The co-writer and constant help with this podcast is Julie Carricker. The thoughts expressed on this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of Barron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The films and television shows discussed and heard in these podcasts remain the property of their respective owners. Not Just Yesterday, the Roddy McDowell Podcast is not affiliated with any major film or television company, and no copyright infringement is intended. Please visit BarrenSpace.com for this and other amazing content. This has been a Barren Space production.